Windows Azure. As I mentioned to some of you in earlier sessions today, my four talks are in a very strange order. This should have been first, but it isn't. And in fact, I believe there have already been a variety of Introduction to Azure talks. So I'm not wholly sure how this wound up here in the schedule. Nonetheless, here we are, and it's a great topic. So it's worth talking about over and over. It's also true that the way I talk about this might be different than you expect. You're going to see no demos, no code, not even a single screenshot. Because those things just don't matter for getting started with Windows Azure, I believe. In fact, more broadly, when you think about a new technology, I think there are three things you might be concerned with. What it is, why you would care about it, and how to use it. My talks are totally about what and why. I don't do how. But what and why are what drive decisions. And so that's why I think it's so important to start with a big picture view of what this thing is and why you should care about it. All right, so let's go. In the simplest sense, Windows Azure is a public cloud platform. It provides computing resources like virtual machines and storage that are accessible from data centers around the world. There are Azure data centers in the US, in Europe, and in Asia. Great. That's the simplest way to think about it. And right away, when people realize that that's what Azure means, it means running applications and storing data in data centers owned by Microsoft, scattered around the world, two big questions come to their mind. Happens all the time. The first of those questions is always some variant of this. People say, can a public cloud platform really keep my data and my applications safe? I've given talks in cities around the world about public cloud technology like Windows Azure. This is always the first question somebody asks me. In fact, the truth is, this is the polite version of the question. More often, they'll say something like, David, are you out of your mind? Do you really think we're going to put our data and our apps in data centers that are in, where are they? Well, they're in Dublin, Ireland. They're in Amsterdam, Singapore, Hong Kong, and the US. Those are the locations. People say, are you out of your mind? How do we know, they say, that Microsoft or anybody else in this business, Amazon, Google, can actually keep our data safe? What about security, they say? So here's the thing. Turns out that this is not really a security question. People who run data centers, their own data centers for their own companies, lay awake at night pondering, worrying about whether the port settings on their firewalls are correct, or being concerned about whether their disaster recovery strategies will work when they're needed. These are the concerns of folks who run data centers. But in the public cloud world, those things stop being your concern because you can't control them. Microsoft, Amazon, Google, they will not let you come in and check the port settings on their firewalls. They won't let you. You have to trust them. Answer this question? It is, this is not really about security. It's about trust. You must learn to trust your public cloud provider. This is really important to understand. It's all about trust. How do we learn to trust? Well, the answer is, two things must be true. First, the thing we're trying to learn to trust must have some value, some benefit that makes it worth taking the risk to trust. Much of the time, that benefit is lower cost. But second, the thing we're trying to learn to trust must prove to be trustworthy over time. We start small and we build. We have seen this happen so many times. Think about manufacturing in China. If you told me 30 years ago that today half the world's stuff would be made in communist China, I would have laughed you out of the room. But it is. Why? Because we learned to trust over time. There was a reason to learn to trust, low cost. And building things in China proved trustworthy. The same thing has happened with so much else. One more example. Outsourcing software development to Russia. 20 years ago, nobody in the U.S. would have done that. It's probably against the law 20 years ago. I don't know. But today, it's common. Big benefits, lots of smart people, I mean you, and lower costs. So, I believe that right now we're at the beginning of the process of learning to trust public cloud platforms. And organizations so often look at this and think immediately about their most critical applications, their most critical data. Don't do that. Don't do that. Almost nobody starts there. People start with relatively simple scenarios to build trust. What are they? I'll tell you in a few minutes. So, this is about trust, not security. Another thought. About Microsoft specifically, trusting Microsoft. Think about this. What is the world's scariest technology today? The world's scariest technology. Is it nuclear weapons? Is it, I don't know, bioengineered food? No. The world's scariest technology today is Windows Update. I mean, think about it. Every couple of weeks, Microsoft puts in the operating system of all Windows machines new code that does whatever the heck Microsoft wants. And we all just say, yep, sure, install. Yeah, no problem, right? Talk about trust. That trust goes far beyond what we're asked to do in trusting a public cloud platform. That we all do it because there are clear benefits. It makes our systems better most of the time, right? And they've built trust over time. They've proved to be trustworthy over time. So There are lots of examples of this. I think this is happening right now with public cloud platforms, building trust. The second question, though, is always this. It is, okay, suppose I trust this public cloud platform idea. Well, then, can I still meet all of the legal and regulatory requirements that are imposed upon me in the public cloud? Because there are lots of laws that apply to how and where I do computing and store data. Sadly, this answer is more complex than the other one. The answer here is you must understand the rules that apply to you. And that can be hard. It's hard because there are laws and regulations in all sorts of different verticals: financial services, healthcare data, retailing, government. And then those laws vary in different countries: Russia, US, Japan. The result is a matrix of laws and regulations that apply to off-premises computing, such as public cloud platforms like Windows Azure. You know the truth? The truth is that nobody in the whole world understands that matrix. In fact, I think it's likely that nobody in the whole world really understands even any single cell of that matrix. And you know why? It's because so often, whether or not you're in compliance with a given law or regulation in that matrix depends on the opinion of some auditor. Or worse yet, some lawyer. And so it's very difficult to understand the matrix. So what do you do? A couple of things. Those laws are getting better. In the European Union, for example, they're working on harmonizing these laws, which is good. But also, where organizations start is commonly in scenarios where those things don't really apply. What are those? I'll tell you in a few minutes. Still, I do not believe that either this question or the previous one are showstoppers for adopting public cloud platforms. Are they showstoppers for some scenarios? Yes. Absolutely. But it's not difficult to find scenarios that have value, but still let you avoid these problems. And again, we'll discuss those soon. So what is Windows Azure? It's a bunch of services, and there are lots of them. There are more all the time. Here's a list. There are various ways to run applications, various execution models. You can see here the three available right now. I'll discuss these more in a couple of minutes. There are data management technologies, three major ones. There are analytics technologies for analyzing data. There are networking technologies. I'll discuss all these in just a minute or two. There are messaging technologies. There's caching, which is kind of interesting. There's identity, which I will not say any more about in this talk. I discussed those technologies in my first talk this afternoon, if you were in that session. There's mobile services, which I'll also say nothing else about. It was discussed in Scott Guthrie's keynote this morning. It's a set of services on Azure to make it easier to build mobile applications. It's very strange. If you want to build a Windows 8 app for your desktop, you use that. But it's still called mobile services. It also is for phones and tablets and so on. HPC helps you build applications that use lots of CPUs at once in lots of virtual machines. We'll talk about this a little bit. Marketplace helps you buy things, applications and data. And there's support for lots of languages here. .NET, Java, PHP, Python, JavaScript. This is interesting. Because when Azure was first announced 4 years ago, it was purely a .NET platform. Just .NET. Today, it's a lot more than that. So it's not just .NET. In fact, look at this. PHP, Python, Node.js. These things are open source. These are open source. And in just a minute, I'm going to tell you how you can use Linux on Windows Azure. It's called Windows Azure, and it runs Linux. So we've got to stop here. Because you're thinking, Microsoft? Open source? What? And if you're me, you're also thinking this. I don't work for Microsoft. But I've worked in this Microsoft world for quite a while. And I heard Microsoft promise many times in the past to support non-Microsoft technologies. Have you heard these promises? You know what? Those promises were all lies. They were marketing, not lies, okay? Marketing. Not the same thing, are they? I don't think so. However, this time with Azure, when Microsoft promises to support PHP, Python, JavaScript, Linux, MySQL, I actually believe them. Let me tell you why. It's because it's become apparent that in this world, in this market, if they offered only .NET on Windows, they wouldn't have a prayer of success. Not even the smallest chance of success. It's apparent that supporting open source will make them more money. I always trust Microsoft to do the things that will make them more money. So that's why I now believe them. Let's look at some of these. Let's start with execution models. Compute. One of the options is called Windows Azure Virtual Machines. As the name suggests, it lets you create virtual machines that run on Azure. I should tell you, this session is a quick survey over pretty much all of Azure. The one that follows goes into a bit more detail about the main components, such as virtual machines, all of these. So high level right now, a little bit deeper in the next session. You can create VMs from ordinary VHDs that Microsoft supplies, Windows Server, Ubuntu Linux, it's remarkable, or from your own. What this offers is something called IaaS, Infrastructure as a Service. It's commonly pronounced IaaS, the world's ugliest acronym, IaaS. Anybody here familiar with Amazon Web Services, AWS? You can still stay if you raise your hand. It's okay, right? Even though it's tech ed. Right? Okay, a lot of you are. That's like EC2. It's like EC2. Azure also has something called cloud services, which provides PaaS, platform as a service, usually pronounced PaaS. In many ways, it's like virtual machines, IaaS. Your application is still running inside VMs. But now the VMs are much more constrained. You don't choose the VHD, they give you theirs. And the trade-off for that lack of control is they manage things for you. It does a lot more for you. The third option is called websites, and the name says it all. It's web hosting. Just classic web hosting. That's not quite true, but a lot of it is classic shared web hosting. Again, if you care, come to the next talk. We'll look at these guys in a bit more detail. But when would you use these? You use web hosting when you want web hosting, right? Like a website in the cloud. These guys are a little more interesting. IaaS versus PaaS. Virtual machines, remember, provides IaaS. Cloud services provides PaaS. I have to say this. The young woman doing video here looks just like my college girlfriend, who in fact was Russian. Look, and so whenever I look out here, I feel 30 years younger. It's a great thing. Thank you, man. My college girlfriend is now a surgeon somewhere, so maybe you'll be a surgeon someday as well. IaaS versus PaaS, what kinds of scenarios make sense? If I want to do just VMs on demand for dev test, I can do that with IaaS, but I can't with PaaS. I earlier told you that I would let you know what kinds of scenarios people most often began using Azure in. That's one of the big ones. Think about what's required in your organization to get virtual machines for dev test. How long does it take? What do they cost? People very frequently will use Azure or technologies like this to create virtual machines for dev test. It's fast. They're available in minutes. It's very customizable, and it's cheap. In my experience, spinning up virtual machines on Azure is a very common way, is the most attractive way, one of the two attractive ways that organizations start using Azure. It also lets you avoid the regulatory issues, and it doesn't require huge trust. And it relies on virtual machines, IaaS. If I want to build an application that includes a standard database like SQL Server or MySQL, I can also do that on IaaS, virtual machines. Turns out that in the PaaS technology, I can't do that. There are some constraints with PaaS, I told you. One of them is you can't install things like an arbitrary database. You have to use what Microsoft gives you. I can deploy packaged applications like SharePoint on IaaS. And people do that today for a variety of reasons. One of them is that it lets you avoid your central IT department, which tends to resist things or be slow. If you create VMs in the cloud, you can do what you want in many companies. You also can't do that on PaaS. Disaster recovery. IaaS lets me have VMs I can spin up when I need them, when disaster strikes. It can be an attractive way of doing disaster recovery because the alternative is a data center that you sit there paying for all the time that's mostly unused. Using IaaS for disaster recovery can be very attractive. You also can't do that with PaaS, cloud services. What if I want to take my current applications and move to the public cloud? I can do that with IaaS. It might or might not work with PaaS, cloud services, depends on the application. A couple of comments here. First, do you want to move your current app to the public cloud? People often look at platforms like Azure and assume that's what they'll do. But the reality is that that's not where most organizations start. They don't. They start with simpler things like my first scenario, VMs on demand for dev tests. Why? They've got to build trust. And there are regulatory concerns. So, I think that 10 years from now, we'll all be running lots of our apps in the public cloud. But in my experience, most organizations don't start there. They start up there. And one more comment. When Microsoft first released Windows Azure, first made it available, they only supported PaaS. There was no IaaS support. The IaaS support is still in preview, in fact. Looking at this list, you got to ask yourself, well, wait a minute. They only ship PaaS? No IaaS support? Why would anybody even want PaaS? There's a good answer. And that is for building new applications. For new applications, you can use both IaaS and PaaS. And PaaS is, in many, probably even most situations, better. Why? Less management, less risk, faster development. So for building new apps, PaaS has a lot going for it. But for many other scenarios, PaaS is not a viable option. How about data? Three big options for data management. SQL database was once called SQL Azure. It provides managed relational storage, PaaS relational storage in the cloud. It is, in essence, a version of SQL Server in the cloud, not full SQL Server, but it looks much like SQL Server. There's an option called table storage, which, despite its name, does not support relational tables. It's, in fact, a NoSQL technology in the category called a key value store. If you care, I'll discuss it more in the last talk here today, the one after this. It's simple and very scalable and quite cheap. But it's also limited in a bunch of ways. And finally, blobs. Blobs are big, fat, binary chunks of data. Blobs are like a SAN in the cloud in many ways. When would I use these? SQL database makes sense when I want managed relational storage, PaaS relational storage, for applications built using either IaaS or PaaS. either virtual machines or cloud services, or with web hosting, with websites. In fact, by default, websites you create using Windows Azure websites will use SQL Database. So will mobile services. Those we saw demoed by Scott Guthrie this morning at the end of the keynote. Table storage makes sense when you want simple, scalable, and cheap data storage for your applications. It's non-relational, though, so the model is going to feel odd, and you can't use reporting tools that you know and so on. It's not relational. It's a NoSQL technology. Finally, blobs. Cheap, unstructured storage for backups or, this is important, extending your on-premises storage. In the last few years, lots and lots of organizations have installed SANs, storage area networks, these big devices with lots of disk that's shared by many computers. There is a product called Store Simple. Microsoft bought the company a couple months ago that does something really interesting. Store Simple is a SAN. It sits in your data center on premises. It's got local storage. But it's a SAN with a connection to Windows Azure Blobs. The Store Simple SAN moves data back and forth between the on-prem storage and blobs based on access. If you stop accessing a block of data, it backs it up, moves it off to the cloud. You want it back again, it brings it back. Under the covers, transparently. Why is this good? Because blob storage on Azure is so much cheaper than SAN storage on premises. I told you earlier that one of the two most common scenarios I see for organizations starting to use Windows Azure is VMs on demand for dev tests. The other most common entry point for enterprises using Windows Azure is blob storage. For backups, with Store Simple, something else. Those two scenarios are what I have seen by a wide majority of the most popular choices. Why? They both provide obvious value, cost savings, and they're both fairly low risk. I've talked about things being cheaper. How does pricing work? Pricing can get fairly complicated. But the important things to know are these. For compute, virtual machines or cloud services, you pay between 2 cents and $1.10 per instance per VM per hour. The price varies with how big your VM is and what it can do. Some VMs, for example, have SQL Server in them. They cost more. The prices are all quoted in US dollars and then converted into local currencies based on where you are. So that's why I'm giving these in dollars and not rubles. Official pricing is in dollars. So you pay per VM per hour. And be aware, this pricing is not usage-based. If you've got a VM that's running for an hour, and in that hour it's used by nobody at all, sits there empty, unused, you'll be charged just the same as if that VM was used by 1,000 people. It's not usage-based. It's wall clock time based. For storage, relational storage costs between $1 and $10 per gigabyte per month, depending on the size of your database. The more you store, the less it costs per gig. Blobs and tables are much cheaper, between about 4 cents and 12 and a half cents per gig per month. But in both cases, you're paying per gig per month. Take data away, you stop paying. It's all usage-based. And the third thing that most often defines overall pricing is bandwidth. Microsoft does not charge you to move data into its data centers. That's free. Why? Because once data is in its data centers, it then starts charging you to store that data. And so they're happy to have you give them data they can charge you to store. They're good with this. For data moved out, however, you pay between 5 cents and 12 cents per gigabyte in the US and Europe, and a bit more in Asia. So you pay for bandwidth sent to your users, back to your own data center, and so on. Those three things, outbound bandwidth, storage, and compute, are typically what drives overall pricing. It's all usage-based. One of the key aspects of being a cloud in the minds of most people, including me, is some kind of usage-based pricing like this. Oh, and this is important. If you have an enterprise agreement with Microsoft, you get discounts on these. You won't see these prices. That'll be less. Interesting question. Suppose you took an application that you currently have running in your own data center and move it to Windows Azure. Would Azure be cheaper than your own data center? The honest answer is you almost certainly don't know, because you don't know what your actual costs are in your data center today. On a per application basis. And you know, if you ask your IT guys what the costs are, they will lie to you, because they want to make sure they're cheaper than this. People view this as a competitor, and they're probably right to do so. So if you're interested in moving apps to Azure to save money, the first thing you have to do is understand on a per application basis what it costs you to run those apps on premises, including electric power, data center space, admin salaries, electricity, all that stuff. Back to technologies here. Business analytics. SQL reporting, as the picture suggests, creates reports based on data in SQL database. HD Insight is Microsoft's name for its Hadoop service on Windows Azure. When would you use those things? Well, it's pretty obvious. SQL reporting you'd use when you want reports produced on SQL database data. It's a cloud-based subset of SQL reporting services. HD Insight is Hadoop. Hadoop, as most of you probably know, has become the industry's standard tool for processing big data, which usually means large amounts of unstructured, that is, non-relational data. It also supports other Hadoop technologies like Pig and Hive, and it lets you access the results and submit jobs through Excel, which is kind of interesting. Anybody here use Hadoop at all? Any Hadoop users? I see one tentative hand in the back. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Thank you. I will talk more about that in the next presentation if you care. Networking. Windows Azure Virtual Network lets you establish a VPN connection, a virtual private network connection, between your own on-premises network and some group of virtual machines in a Windows Azure data center. It's a VPN connection between those two. Windows Azure Connect lets you connect specific machines, not the whole network, just certain machines in your own data center with certain VMs or an application in Windows Azure. And Windows Azure Traffic Manager lets you spread users across data centers. When would you use these? Virtual network is really useful when you are extending an on-premises data center into the public cloud. When you want the VMs in Windows Azure to look like an extension of your own data center. However, doing this requires hardware, a VPN gateway device, and it requires agreement and work from your network admin. This is an issue because lots of network admins aren't crazy about hooking their own network via a VPN to the outside world like Windows Azure. Connect, as I said, lets you connect a cloud app or group of VMs in the cloud to specific machines on premises. In some ways, it's a subset of what virtual network allows. But this does not require new hardware or your network admin's approval. A dev can do this. Finally, Traffic Manager is useful if you have an application that's running in multiple Windows Azure data centers, such as Singapore, Dublin, and a couple in the US. This technology can intelligently route users based on policies you define to the right data center. It's meaningful primarily with big apps that run around the world. Messaging and integration. There's a technology called Windows Azure Queues, and there's one called Windows Azure Service Bus, which provides queues. There's actually two different queuing technologies in Windows Azure. Why is this? Because this technology is from Microsoft, who frequently lets different groups do similar things. When would you use these? Well, the most common use of Windows Azure Queues and their original purpose was to connect web and worker roles in cloud services applications. If you recall, cloud services is the PaaS technology, and it gives you predefined roles for VMs. called web roles and worker roles. They can interact via queues. That was the original purpose of this technology. It's now used a bit more broadly. Service bus is somewhat similar, except it is commonly used quite a bit more broadly than Windows Azure queues. Service bus provides queues in the cloud, but those queues can be used to connect two applications running on premises. You could connect, for example, an app on your phone to an app in your own data center via Windows Azure queues in the cloud. Or you might connect two apps in the cloud via service bus queues. Or you might connect a cloud app with an on-premises app. They're really just queues in the cloud to be used as you see fit. Caching. This one's easy. One of the thing, this is so odd. The category is called caching, and one of the technologies is called caching. So it's kind of confusing. Do you know what memcache is? If you know what memcache is, this caching is like memcache. It provides support for in-memory caching of data for Windows Azure applications. Another kind of caching caches data, but not for applications. It's the Content Delivery Network, the CDN. Windows Azure has its own CDN, analogous to Akamai and other vendors in this space. It lets you distribute blob data to users around the world more effectively by caching it at points all around the globe. The idea is users can access the cached copy and thus get much faster access. It's a CDN. Scenarios, I just said these things. A really common scenario for CDNs is video access, where users around the world want to access video data stored in blobs. The CDN will store that data on disks at points all around the world for faster access to data access repeatedly. What else? Identity. You can run Windows Server Active Directory in VMs. You can run ordinary Windows Server AD in IaaS VMs, Windows Azure Virtual Machines VMs. You can also use Windows Azure Active Directory. These are totally different things. Windows Azure Active Directory is not a version of the on-premises AD running in the cloud. It's not. It's a different technology designed for use with SaaS applications. Its purpose is analogous to Windows Azure AD, except it focuses on SaaS applications. Well, Windows Azure AD focuses on users and machines and all kinds of things. There's also a technology called Windows Azure Active Directory Access Control, which wins the prize for longest name. This guy lets your application more easily accept logins by users that want to use as their login their Facebook identity or Google or Windows Live ID or something else. So when would you use each of these? You'd probably run Windows Server Active Directory, conventional AD, in VMs in Windows Azure when what you're trying to do is use Windows Azure as an extension to your own data center. It more easily gives your enterprise user a single sign-on to enterprise apps that are running in Windows Azure VMs, like SharePoint. Windows Azure AD, however, is a bot giving you access, single sign-on, to SaaS applications. A good example there is Office 365. If you use Office 365, which is a suite of SaaS applications and more, you will be using under the covers Windows Azure AD. And finally, as I mentioned before, Windows Azure AD Access Control makes it easier for applications to let their users log in using various identities from Google or Facebook or other things. We're almost done here with our quick tour of Windows Azure. Media services. This is interesting. Fairly specialized, but interesting. Media services is a set of technologies running in the cloud for processing and, if you choose, distributing media, principally video. The applications that use media services might run in the cloud or on premises. Either one. Microsoft provides a bunch of components. It provides one that does media ingest, for example. These media guys have their own vocabulary. All that means is uploading video. But it's called media ingest. Sounds much cooler, doesn't it, than uploading video? There's an encoding component that lets you translate video to different formats. There's content protection, which lets you put watermarks in video. You can track where it came from, dealt with copyright violations. There's ad insertion, let you put ads in the stream of video if you want to. There's streaming. Streaming support lets you, if you want to, use this platform to distribute your video through, if you choose, a CDN. You can use either the Azure CDN or a third-party CDN there. It need not be Azure CDN. Microsoft provides more components than this. But more interesting in some ways is that partners can also supply components. This is a platform to which people like you, if you choose to, can add. When would you use this? Well, an obvious thing is if you want to build a Windows Azure-based media service that processes and distributes video. This is not YouTube, but it's a platform to build YouTube on. If you chose to build something like YouTube, this would be a foundation you could use to do that. But don't be confused. Media services is not solely for YouTube-like things. I might also have a desktop app that's sold to video production houses that relies on these cloud services. I can ingest media, upload video, and then process that video, encoding and so on, bring it back again. This is not only for cloud-based apps. I could just as well have a desktop app that uses these services. And there you have it. The world's fastest tour through all of Windows Azure. I began, you might remember, talking about things like security and trust and regulatory concerns. And the reason I did that was, well, because the questions always come up, and also because they're really important issues. The truth, I believe, is this. The truth is that given this broad range of services, and given the fact that public cloud platforms have become a more and more important part of our world, I think that all of us, with every new app we build, with every new VM we create, with all data we store, I think we should always, always consider the cloud. Is a public cloud platform like Windows Azure always the best answer? No, by no means. But when we're looking for computing resources or storage, does it make sense to always think about this option and consider whether it's helpful for us? I think the answer is yes. I think cloud computing is already changing our world in big ways, and those changes are just going to get bigger. Thank you.
Presentation. I have a question.
Yes.
Can I build?